Ladies and gentlemen, here is Frank Tashlin, director of The Lieutenant Wore Skirts and The Girl Can't Help It, shooting a scene with Jane Mansfield for Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, the howling Broadway comedy hit.
Leave and walk out on all this publicity?
And accompanying Jane on this mad whirl are all of the wonderful pals who made the play one of Broadway's most delight-filled entertainments. Tony Randall as the TV commercial writer who became a national hero. Betsy Drake as his bewildered fiancé. Joan Blondell as the social secretary. Lily Gentle as the teenage autograph hunter. And Mickey Hargitay as the gorilla man. Jane's really got him up a tree.
Ticklish business any way you look at it. Come on, we'll stick together.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Ticklish Business, the podcast devoted to honoring and deconstructing classic cinema. I'm your host, Kristen Lopez. Dre Clark is out this week, and Samantha Ellis is suffering from the same post-TCM cold that I am still in the midst of. Thankfully, we have a guest this week to talk about, Jane Mansfield. We're actually recording this on Jane Mansfield's birthday. How fortuitous that we have a guest who knows a lot about Jane Mansfield and the film we're talking about this week, 1957's Will Success Spoil Rock Hunters. April Vivier. April, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Kristen?
I am doing great. Thank you so very, very much for taking the time out to talk with us today.
Oh, yeah, of course. Anytime I can talk about Jane, but especially being it's her birthday.
I did not plan it this way. We just said, when are we available to record? This is the day that it came up and it ends up being her birthday, which I find to be just proof of how necessary this episode is. April, you are the author of the book Publicity.
There's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears that have gone into it. I'm finishing up the second volume for it right now, which will actually be out in June. I absolutely love Jane, as you can tell.
What inspired you to study her and write this book?
Oh, goodness. So I was actually very involved in the Maryland world and the Monroe community for about 10 years. Jane kept popping up.
As she tends to do.
She does. She's always popping up or popping out, isn't she? She popped up, and I'm going to be very honest with you. I thought, oh, this is just somebody who wants to impersonate Marilyn, because that's what we've all heard. I finally was like, oh, I guess I should give her a chance. And I fell in love with Jane. And that was like late 2015. So I've been devoted exclusively to Jane now for almost 4 years.
In writing the book, other than the fact that she's not a Marilyn impersonation, which is the common misconception, was there something specific that you learned that you were like, oh my gosh, we're reshaping the narrative here?
So I actually did. It was the Sophia Loren photos at Romanoff's.
Oh my gosh, that infamous photo that I think everybody's seen.
Yeah, it's definitely in pop culture history, isn't it? I had to dig deep into that one. We all have heard the story, and the story is that Paramount threw the party for Sophia to welcome her. Jane came in uninvited, crashed the party, put out her boobs, and that's the narrative that we've all heard. But I actually discovered that Fox threw the party for Sophia because they had gotten the distribution rights for Sophia's Italian film, The Boy on a Dolphin. It was a very well-organized publicity stunt, and I am a very firm believer that it was not just Jane who organized the stunt, because this sounds so weird because I obviously don't know Jane, but Jane would follow a very specific format for her publicity stunt. She'd come in, she'd always have a date, she would make sure that they got photos, she would do like these little stunts building up to her big stunt, and she would relish in it. With this one, reports differ, but Jane was likely there for no longer than an hour. I would estimate it was closer to 30 minutes. She basically came in, took those pictures, and left. Jane spoke out about it with Luella Parsons within like a week or so of it happening, and she put the blame on Fox, and I actually think she was being honest on that, because she sat there, she put on Fox with Luella Parsons, and Fox didn't speak out against her. And as we know, Marilyn is a perfect example. Fox was very keen on speaking out if someone was lambasting the studio or anything like that. And Fox was completely silent. Jane got her statement out there. She said that Fox had told her to come. I don't think that Jane knew exactly how much of herself was exposed, just because Jane would have wanted those pictures to run. And only one picture ran in the United States in newspapers, and it's Jane from behind. It's just not a typical Jane stunt. She would later take credit for it as being her sole invention, but I highly doubt that.
Well, what was the first Jane movie that you ever saw? Can you remember it?
Yeah, it was actually The Loves of Hercules. It's one of those Italian-like epics that is very low budget, and if anyone was to watch that as their first Jane movie, they would probably never want to see another one of her movies. Mickey co-stars with her as Hercules. It's a genuinely horrible movie. Jane actually had to call Fox because she was still under contract with them when that movie was made, because the movie had run out of money. They didn't have anything left, and she told Fox that they needed to provide the money for the movie so that it could be finished. She was a star, and Fox did it. It makes sense, though, when you think about it, because Fox was earning around $200,000 every time they loaned her out, and that was in 1961.
I come at this from a very different angle, because this was the first film of hers I'd ever seen, the film we're talking about today. I know who she was as a personality than knowing who she was as an actress, which is very sad, because as you've mentioned, she does get this bum rap of being a Marilyn imposter almost. I can recall very vividly sitting through the Jane Mansfield story, which if anybody remembers that, that's the 1980s movie with Loni Anderson. She hit a lot of those classic film actress made for TV movies of the 70s and the 80s and the 90s. She also played Thelma Todd in a movie that's also highly entertaining. Loni Anderson played Jane Mansfield. Arnold Schwarzenegger played Mickey Hargate. And it's everything you would expect from a made for TV look at Jane Mansfield's life. Probably wasn't the best entry into her work.
That movie's interesting. They open up saying that Jane passed away at 36. So that's pretty much all you need to know about the accuracy of the movie.
They obviously didn't have any facts that they were working with here.
The sad part is that movie is actually based on what is considered to be the definitive biography of Jane. It's Jane Mansfield in the American 50s by Martha Saxton. Excellent book. She doesn't go either way on Jane in it. Hollywood got a hold of the book and turned it into garbage.
What research did you do while you were writing this? And are there biographies on her that you would recommend?
I would definitely recommend Saxton's. I would also recommend Richard Koper's Affectionately Jane Mansfield. Richard is based in Amsterdam. He is an excellent biographer of 1950s blondes, who doesn't focus on Marilyn. His book is from the standpoint of like how Jane's films were received, and he basically tells her life through her filmography. It's a really unique way to write a book. I absolutely adore it. As far as books on Jane, with my book, there's about 20. And one of those was actually written by Jane, and another one was written by Mickey. She's a difficult person to find anything on. All of Jane's belongings were auctioned off. Everything that was in her house. Her paperwork that wasn't thrown away was auctioned off. Clothing, her animals. They had a pet auction because she had so many pets. Anything Jane owned was auctioned off in a series of auctions between 1967 and 1968. Her stuff is very spread out. I'm lucky to own Jane's first studio contract from Warner Brothers, the piece de la resistance of my collection. It's really hard to find anything that's overly personal. I have a couple other contracts, but that's, of course, the big one. Most of my research is actually from newspapers, and I wanted to track how the public looked at Jane, because we hear, as we have talked about multiple times in this interview, we hear this narrative that she was this Marilyn wannabe and she wasn't talented, and there's very popular myth that she was just a very unpopular actress, and that really isn't true. From 1956 to 1958, she was actually the most popular actress in Hollywood when it came to like public perception. People put her on the one celebrity they'd won a date list, and she was the most photographed woman of 56 and 57, and that's been lost. The Girl Can't Help It made more money than Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, but we don't hear that because it doesn't fit into what the public perceives Jane to be. Went through newspapers, went through thousands and thousands of newspapers, got everything I possibly could on Jane and tracked her life through the 50s. I would love to do something a little more personal on Jane, but it's also nearly impossible because she doesn't have a nice and neat archive, or like she hasn't had a big auction like the Monroe auctions where people can see hundreds of pages of documents. So it's been a very surreal life.
Now that I've been researching Jane for this episode, bring up something that I always say about Veronica Lake, who I love, who's another blonde who was very popular, and people tend to forget that. These poor women die and then all their stuff disappears, and family is not always willing to discuss things, and it becomes almost like a really weird puzzle trying to figure out stuff on your own. And as much as people assume that technology has made searching for things easier, it really hasn't.
That's definitely an understatement. Margaret Herrick has been very helpful because I can see what Jane wrote to people, but of course I don't see a whole lot of their responses back to her. So I kind of have to piece things together from that standpoint. I totally feel you on Veronica Lake. My hat goes off to you on attempting to research her, because especially with her mother, that's very difficult. I know I keep bringing up Marilyn, but she, as you know, everything of hers has been auctioned off. And there's so much out there. People think, oh, well, every celebrity must be like this. And that's really not the case. I like how you brought up family. Her family is pretty private, and I don't push them. I'm friends with one of her sons on Facebook, and I've met another one of her sons in Los Angeles, and they are always very nice to me and everything, but I don't push them for stories because that is their mother, and they are entitled to their memories.
It's the tough world of being a classic film. I don't ever consider myself a biographer in any sense. It's a struggle. Well, I always say, if I had started doing this 20 years ago when more people were still alive and available, who knows how different it would be.
Most definitely. I read through the old Jane Mansfield newsletters from the 1980s, and they're finding Jane's stuff at swap meets.
People forget Marilyn's image. I want to say her estate went to Lee Strasberg. Her image has been monetized, and the estate now is an estate. And many celebrities of that time, I know from researching Veronica, didn't die with wills. No estate, there's no trust, there's nobody to say where their image goes. So, like, theoretically, I could profit off of Veronica Lake's image if I wanted to, because there's nothing in writing. Nothing has ever been filed. That happens with a lot of these actresses, especially. They just fade because, I hate to say it, nobody's profiting off of their image, so it's not ubiquitous. It's this weird double-edged sword.
No, it definitely is. And, you know, CMG does own Jane's image to put on for licensing purposes and everything, but they don't do anything with it.
It's a shame.
It is. It keeps my eBay prices lower because people aren't obsessed with her. But there is a very real struggle of trying to get the real person out there for people to appreciate. And people, they want to hold on to what our urban myths are. Jane was a Satanist. Jane crashed Sophia Loren's party, stuff like that. And it's a process.
That segues us nicely into our feature discussion, which is Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter from 1957. This is the second film that she made with Frank Tashlin, right? Frank Tashlin is a director whose work before this, I didn't get him. I've seen a couple of his films. I didn't like them. This, I can thankfully say, I really did like. He directed Susan Slept Here, I think. Mm-hmm. Which, if you have not seen that movie, you should after this. Because all of his movies are really weird, and they have really weird relationships. And that's an understatement. Because so many times watching this movie, I was just thinking, oh my god, this is a thing that exists. Plot in a nutshell before we start deconstructing it. Tony Randall stars as Rockwell Hunter. That is a name that does not belong to Tony Randall at all, but that is his name in this movie. He is an advertising grunt trying to get his commercials made, and he wants to keep the last client for his company, which is a lipstick company, but nobody will listen to his ideas. Thanks to his niece, who is practically 30 years old, she discovers that international superstar Rita Marlowe, played by Jane Mansfield, is in town, and his goal is to get her endorsement on the lipstick so that he can save his job and save the company and essentially get that key to the executive washroom, which is the apotheosis of all white male executives of the 1950s. But of course, that comes with complications because Rita has broken up with her beau back in the States, Bobo Branigansky, played by Mickey Hargitay with a fake chest. So she decides when Rock shows up to her house to pretend that he is her boyfriend. That creates a series of shenanigans where people assume that Rockwell P. Hunter is dating Rita Marlowe. And so both of them are profiting off this publicity in different ways. A lot happens in an hour and 33 minute movie. I had never seen this movie. I had heard about it. I had never seen it. I got to watch it and I enjoyed it, but it is so bizarre. This is a very honest satire of the 1950s made by somebody who is almost preconceiving the 1970s like sex comedy. It's very funny, but it's also very frank in how overt the sex talk is, and nothing makes sense. I will say that Jane Mansfield is damn delightful in this movie, playing a character that is a Marilyn spinoff, but that's the point. It works. But April, what was your background with this prior to us talking about it? What do you think of it?
Let me just start by saying that this was actually one of the last Jane movies I watched. I wanted to build up to it because people always say it's her best movie. I watched it the first time and I hated it. I didn't get it. I was just like, this is weird. Her impression of Marilyn is so like caricature-y that I don't find it to be enjoyable. I can see why people think she's this Marilyn knockoff. Couldn't stand it. Watch it a second time and I loved it. I know that probably sounds really weird. He brought up a very, very good point about Toshlin. His whole thing is satire. One of his quotes about Jane was that he found a woman with big breasts to be the funniest thing on the planet. He just thought she was so out of proportion. I think a lot of that does tie back to his time at Warner Brothers doing Looney Tunes. He helped create Porky Pig. He did so much work as an animator. And that crosses over to his films. You have to watch a few times to appreciate it. I totally understand where you're coming from about thinking this movie is just weird, but it is the perfect satire on the 50s. I also think you brought up a really great point, Kristen, about how it foreshadows future sex comedies. And he was really just a genius on how to get around things with the censors. If you go on Margaret Herrick's website, you can actually see the Hayes Office notes on this movie. It's like 30 pages.
I can believe that. This is a movie where classic film actress Joan Blondell makes a comment, and I believe it's when Jane is in a bubble bath reading Peyton Place of all things, and she says the last guy she dated, all she ended up doing was polishing his Oscar. And I was just like, oh my God, we actually went there. That is amazing. And they all say it with a very straight face. At the same time, I never felt like, yes, this movie posits Jane's character as ubiquitous with the 50s sex kitten. She's Marilyn Monroe, but she's also Rita Hayworth a little bit in there. But the movie really never seemed to make fun of her. It says that she's playing the game. She's playing the publicity game. She's actually the smartest person, if you really think about it, because she understands how Hollywood works, and she's just doing what she can. Everybody else is very resistant to it, or they're trying to act like they're above it, especially Rock. He's trying to say that he hasn't changed. But really, he has. I mean, the only one who's honest with themselves is Rita.
That's a good point. When she's driving Rock in the car, she goes and give up all this free publicity. She's not going to do it. And you're right. She's playing the game. Axelrod didn't care for Marilyn after Bus Stop. And that's why he wrote Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter, the stage play, because of course Jane played Rita on Broadway. she really is the smartest person in the entire movie. She can't get her personal life straight to save her soul, but she knows how to play the game and she knows how to stay on top. Everyone thinks she's the dumb blonde, and it really basically predicting how Jane's life is going to be. But everyone thinks she's the dumb blonde and they don't take her seriously as an actress. But at the end of the day, she's getting the last laugh and she's pocketing all the money.
The squealing in this movie sounds like a dolphin at a certain point. And I get what the intent is, but what I really appreciated is that she doesn't say her lines like Marilyn does. And I love Marilyn, so full disclosure, I can criticize her because I love her. Marilyn's laugh lines did often feel like laugh lines. The way she would say certain words or look at the camera, or look at characters, you could tell the intent was to get a laugh out of people. With Jane, I mean, it's all said with a straight face. All those moments where they're on the TV, her and Joan Blondell's character, where she's like, don't talk dirty on TV. It's a family medium. She just says it so bluntly. And I really appreciated that because she's this character that understands the persona. I wasn't sure, and you can tell me if I was hallucinating this, her accent changes several times in this movie. Sometimes she sounds like she's got a little bit of a twang, but then sometimes she doesn't. And I was like, okay, is she able to relax more in private? And that's like an intentional tick? Or was she just really unable to hold whatever vocal cadence? I was really confused, but I was also fascinated by it.
I know obviously what you're talking about, like when she's in the apartment with Rock and chasing him around and stuff like that. She falls more into her Texas accent. Jane never had like a super strong Texas accent, probably because she didn't move there until she was six, but there was a little bit of one. And Jane's voice was actually very, very deep. If anyone wants to hear a real voice, they can just go on YouTube and they can type in JFK Jane Mansfield. It's after he was assassinated. She's talking and her voice sounds completely different. Like, everyone should watch that clip. Marilyn also had this fake, like, high-pitched, squealy public voice. And I think that's what she's trying to portray, but she falls more into her own voice. So again, it's kind of just foreshadowing how she is, but she's still, like, keeping it on. The weird thing with Jane was, though, Diana Dors had performed with her, and she said at the end of their time together, she thought that Jane really did speak and act like a Cupid doll all the time. She could keep that voice on for hours. And Rock Hunter's really unique because she does fall in and out and you can hear hints of her real voice.
We have to talk about Mickey Hargitay in this one scene that he is in. It was my favorite scene in the movie. We're going to get into the satire and what this movie is making fun of in a sec. I knew I was kind of in love with this movie when you are introduced to Mickey Hargitay, who plays Bobo, the jungle man, who's supposed to be like a Tarzan ripoff. He literally shows up in this leopard print banana hammock. And I was shocked that the censors weren't like, okay, no, none of this can happen right here. I mean, that's all he's wearing. He's got like fake hair on his chest, which they call to. He's like, I'm losing my hair. It's this hilarious moment of meta humor in a movie that's all meta humor. If you knew that they were together, then that was obviously more pointed that you were getting this kind of glimpse at their relationship. But I like that this is a movie that calls out this publicity showman's type of thing. But at the same time, again, both actors are playing it incredibly straight. And I was like, Mickey Hargitay is either the greatest actor ever, or this movie's just really suited for him. Because I thought he was hilarious and very effective and also highly distracting.
Mickey actually isn't a horrible actor. I know I was kind of slamming it earlier, but if you watch The Loves of Hercules, it's also known as Hercules versus the Hydra, and you can look past the incredibly lousy budget and horrible animatronic monster, he actually does show acting talent. Mickey, by all accounts, was a very friendly, jovial person, but he was also very work-oriented. And after his divorce from Jane in 64, he did go on to make a bunch of Italian films. I think it's a combination of him having some acting talent. It's just very raw acting talent. And then the script obviously fits him perfectly. He was definitely a scene stealer.
He is, and it works really well. This is a movie that, for somebody who had worked in short films and cartoons like Toshlin did, this movie has a really big hatred for television. It starts out with breaking the fourth wall with Tony Randall trying to do all the musical bits in the opening 20th Century theme song. And then he introduces the movie, a la like Carl Laemmle, if this was a 1930s Universal horror film, calling out the fact that he's like, we're starring in this movie. The girl can't help it. Wait, that was the last movie. At a certain point, the movie breaks as if it's a commercial. And they're trying to praise the benefits of television while showing you that, oh, it's such a wide screen and it shows you the size of like an average TV and it's such a clear picture, and then it starts to fuzz up and make all the typical 1950s television issues that you would have. And watching this in 2019, where we all watch movies on our TVs or our phones, that had an odd prescience to it, that this movie is calling out a medium that then was slowly becoming ubiquitous. And now we've even gone smaller with our screens. And we're still having this discussion about the best way to watch a movie. Toshlin like really had his finger on the pulse of not just what was happening in 57, but what would be happening 40 years from now.
Well, the Broadway play was making fun of movies. Axelrod was extremely upset. He had written The Seven-Year Itch. And it was so sanitized for the movie, and he absolutely hated it. So he wrote Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter as an F you. That's the best way to describe it, to the studio system. And he was just like, I hate movies. They ruin Broadway, blah, blah, blah. Well, when Fox went and bought the Will Success Spoil Rock Hunter rights, they had Toshlin and Axelrod work together, mostly Toshlin, though, and completely gut it to be like, TV is horrible. Toshlin, I would imagine, probably did have some animosity towards TV just because it took away from his stuff. And Axelrod, I don't really know his feelings on it. It's definitely like, TV is a horrible medium. You should enjoy movies. The studio in 57 is really dealing with TV taking people out of movie theaters. Right. Why would you go and pay 25 cents when you can watch something? I shouldn't say for free, but you know what I mean. You can just sit in your pajamas and watch any TV show you want to watch. This is also when they start syndicating older movies. So people can watch movies at home in their pajamas, just like we do today. See, that's why I love this movie, because there's so much foreshadowing of what's to come, but there's no way that Toshlin knew about it. That argument still continues until today, which I love that you pointed that out. People are still going on about the best method of watching movies, and sadly, I think a lot of people have turned, like you said, to television and smartphones. They don't want to have to pay for the theater experience and sit with kids or pay $14 for a ticket, even though a lot of movies are best on the big screen. But I digress.
They are, yes. George Axelrod, you brought a lot of his stuff was adapted to film, and yet he directed two movies, one of which I've seen, and I think it might be weirder than this movie. In 1966, he directed Lord Love a Duck, which if anybody's seen that film, that is weirder than this movie, and that is saying a lot. I haven't seen it in at least 2 years. I remember it's Roddy McDowall, he's in love with Tuesday Weld, and there's questions about how old he is. At least I had questions because she's in high school. I just remember something about how she's having some weird moment, like trying on a sweater for her dad. It's a very strange film. That was his thing, because watching this movie, it was something the movie doesn't delve into, but it's enough that I kept noticing it. So Rock Hunter has a niece. This is the 1950s equivalent of a ward. April, played by Lily Gentle. April Hunter is the oldest looking high schooler. I'm sorry, but she looked about 35. And there's a scene where he like comes into her room to kiss her goodnight. And it's the most bizarre scene ever filmed, because you're just like, why is this threatening? This is weird. I'm not understanding it.
April Hunter's a bit of a weird character.
And she just disappears from the narrative at a certain point, never really comes back.
Yeah. We only see her really when she's cleaning the apartment, when she thinks Rita's going to go up there, and then we don't see her again until the very end when she's feeding animals. She's an underutilized character, I think, but I also understand that she's supposed to be like, look how important teen culture is. Lily had actually also appeared in The Girl Can't Help It, also playing a high schooler. But you only see her for like 2 seconds. She doesn't have any lines.
Axelrod, when he made Lord Love a Duck, I want to say that was supposed to be looking at beach party films, almost like a lampoon of that genre, which by the 60s had taken over. And here, there is a little bit of that in the sense that April Hunter decides to blow off school to show up at the airport in the days when you could actually show up as somebody's plane lands on the tarmac. And she is the one from the fan club, the president of the Rita Marlowe fan club of New York, and Rita just blows her off. But really, Rock ends up profiting off of his niece's idea. And this is a film that not just lampoons Hollywood, but also the commodification that Hollywood had created. I think most of us remember, if you've looked at fan magazines, celebrities endorsed really weird things. Remember, Humphrey Bogart was endorsing like Whitman's chocolates. I saw an ad once for that in like an old 1940s photo play. But really, celebrities would put their name on anything if they got the right price, which we still see today. If you watch 1950s television, the ad executive was always a thing, whether it was Bewitched or, you know, any of those shows, they were always in advertising. There's this really unique symbiosis of celebrity as embodied by Rita and Rock dealing with the advertising, which these are these two parasitic type of relationships that they need the celebrities in order to endorse the products, and the celebrities need the products in order to make a reason for publicity. Like at the end, Rita is at this television program and she's like, I'm not supposed to mention all these lipsticks, and then she starts mentioning them. Like she needs an excuse to talk about them, and at the same time, those very things need her to talk about them. So it's this really weird relationship that is treated with almost a bit of a horror vibe in terms of just how close it has to be. You're seeing art and commerce practically in bed together if you read them, these characters as metaphors.
Well, I mean, look where we are now with product placements in television shows and movies. You know what I mean? God, again, yes. It's foreshadowing. Jane was someone who played the game when it came to endorsements. She actually endorsed her own lipstick range a few years after this. They're super hard to find, so if anyone never finds one, let me know and I'll buy it. She had lipsticks that she endorsed. She endorsed bras. She endorsed headscarves. Obviously, her Jane Mansfield water bottles. Her barbell set with Mickey. She endorsed some Italian soap. Jane was queen of doing these endorsement deals. People forget just how long celebrities have been doing that. There's been some complaints about that, but celebrities have always been doing it. I mean, you know, in the 40s, you see certain celebrities endorsing certain brands of cigarettes. Like you said, Humphrey Bogart's doing chocolate. Television opens itself up, though, so much more, at least in this, in 1957. It's opening itself up to these endorsements. I mean, brands are sponsoring TV shows. We still have that now, but we don't say, like, Clorox Bleach presents this episode of Jeopardy right at the beginning. It was so ad-based in the 50s, and obviously people who've watched shows like Mad Men know that that really continued well into the 60s.
I love the fact that Rita wants to start a production company. She's thinking big. I know Marilyn wanted to do that as well, and even then she was lampooned for it and poked fun at because she wanted to, but I love that that's what she really, really wants to do in this movie. This is a predominantly, I would say, female-based film. Tony Randall's good, but he is the bland dude. He doesn't have the color of, obviously, Jane Mansfield, and he's not as particularly compelling as Joan Blondell's Violet, or even John Williams, who plays Irving LaSalle Jr., the head of the company, who just wants to have a flower named after him, which I thought was some sort of weird Mrs. Miniver joke. He was not in Mrs. Miniver. I just checked. I was like, okay, we're bringing that up. Women really are dealing with the fallout of actions that men have created. So like Betsy Drake, who was Mrs. Cary Grant at the time she made this, who plays Jenny Wells, Rock Hunter's long-suffering girl, they can't get married because they can't afford it. It just sounds like an excuse. She decides she's going to try to do push-ups to get fit, and then she almost dies. She tries to buy undergarments that project her boobs out. She does all these things that, again, are societal creations about what are supposed to make women happy in the 50s. And much of it is created by advertising. There's this very sly, subtle dig at the fact that she's dating a man who is by proxy working for a company that's built to make her feel terrible about herself. And at the same time, you have Joan Blondell's Violet, who says that she's worked for women as assistants since the silent era. She's representative of the old guard. She just wanted to marry the milkman, and love passed her by, which I had to smile at because it sounds like an old 1940s melodrama, which again, I think is the point. These women have so many nuances to them. Then you have Rockwell P. Hunter over here, who's only really interesting in his name.
None of the men really have any redeeming qualities. Rockwell is obviously, like you said, he's obsessed with getting a key to the executive bathroom. That's all he wants out of life. Irving LaSalle Jr. wants his rose garden and to have a flower named after him. And Henry Rufus just wants to get to the top of the food chain. Rockwell really only succeeds because of the women in his life. He has to use April to get to Rita. Rita gets him to the top, and Jenny keeps him grounded. There's not any strong male characters in this movie. And I know that sounds horrible, but if you see it, I think you get what I mean. It's definitely like women make the world go round. And like you said, Betsy Drake is doing push-ups to get bigger bust. That's the whole thing. And same thing with April. They're both trying to get Rita's measurements, which is based off of advertising. But I also think it's based off of like what the female ideal of the time is. A lot of people say, oh, we were just into curvier women in the 1950s. And that really isn't true. I mean, a size 12 at that point was considered the quote unquote perfect size. And that's a modern day size 4. Same beauty standards that we have now. They want, you know, super curvy women who are still very small in the waist. I don't want to say it's a body positive movie, but it's like women should accept themselves. You know what I mean?
It's this weirdly positive look at femininity in a time that I think most people really look at the 50s as this horrible time for women with Donna Reed and domesticity. And this is a movie that has a female heroine who, again, wants to create a production company, who is aware of what is being said about her, and in fact is creating it. She's inviting the press to the Justice of the Peace and trying to sell this guy as a sex symbol. It turns this into that women are the ones who create publicity and create entertainment culture. And that's really true today if you look at thirst tweeting, for better or worse, and how women are the ones that instigate and tell other women who's hot. We all discuss that, whether it's talking about Chris Hemsworth or something on Twitter. In this movie, you're seeing the creation of a male sex symbol because women are saying, one woman tells a friend, and then another woman tells a friend, and then all of a sudden, they're running after this guy, and even buying the fact that his name is Lover Doll, which that is just not a name that any woman wants to hear referred to a man.
Yeah, Tony Randall doesn't really fit that label. I can tell you, her getting to the height of the Cold War when showing the newspaper headlines from around the world and the Russians are trying to claim that he was created by them. They start doing like this takeoff of the Russian anthem, and then the Russian newspaper all goes red.
How did you interpret the end of this movie? Because it ends with Rita finally meeting George Schmidlap, the man that she has been trying to recreate through all the men she's dated. He's the one that got away. It turns out at the end to be Groucho Marx.
Yeah.
I appreciated that in the sense that she's not looking for a guy who's conventionally attractive. And it goes back to that creation of what women find appealing, and that may be unconventional, but obviously the way that she sells Tony Randall, the movie's belief is that women can really sell any guy. They're the best advertisers if they can make George Schmidlap good looking. But then also at the same time, I was like, is it kind of a dig? She ends up with Groucho Marx. I was unclear how to take it.
I'm going to be honest with you. I've always taken that movie as insinuating that they had like a casting couch romp.
Oh,
because
okay.
He sits there. She says, I can't remember exactly what she says, but he's like, I could never get close enough. And it's obviously talking about her boobs.
She says something, George, why didn't you ever try to kiss me
right.
before?
And he's like, I couldn't get close enough, which I know points away from that, but I think that's more of like a way for Toshlin to get around the censors. I wouldn't be shocked because, of course, George gives Rita her start. That's like the whole thing. And that's why she's in love with him. Being there is a lot of Marilyn influence in that, I've always taken George Schmidlap to be like a knockoff version of Johnny Hyde.
Ooh, that would make sense. That would make a lot of sense. It's a really weird way to end it, but you know, all's well that ends well, I guess. I just wish that we had gotten Jane Mansfield and Peyton Place in some way. Can't get over that she's reading that in the bathtub, which I was like, that is amazing.
But again, it's product placement. Just like when he hides behind the cutout of Rita, it's advertising The Girl Can't Help It, which had just been released a few months before.
They're selling Jane Mansfield in a movie that is critiquing television. It's enough to make you go cross-eyed with how either intentionally intelligent this movie is or just all sorts of geeky. And in case you're curious, Frank Toshlin did a lot of movies. In 52, he did Son of Pale Face. He did Susan Slept Here in 54. In 55, he did Artists and Models. After this, he did the Jerry Lewis movie, Cinderfella, in the 60s. The movie that I was talking about that I had seen Frank Toshlin did was 1961's Bachelor Flat with Tuesday Weld and Richard Beamer. And it's not good. Maybe I should watch it again. Maybe my thoughts would change. And I know I have The Glass Bottom Boat because Warner Brothers just put that out on Blu-ray.
And the thing with Toshlin is, too, not all of his movies were super horrible. He worked on The Lieutenant Wore Skirts, which I actually think nice comedy. I'm not saying it's the greatest thing you're ever going to watch, but you know what I mean. He also did One Touch of Venus, which, of course, had Ava Gardner. He did make some good movies. It's when he's also directing them as well as writing them that they go off the walls into like this extreme satire.
The names you listed in the movies that I mentioned, he worked with some titans of female acting, whether it was Jane or Ava Gardner or Tuesday Weld. He had his finger on the pulse of what femininity was looking like in this changing landscape. He made a movie in the late 60s with Doris Day when her persona was changing. It's just amazing that he was working with some of these women that history has really had a hard time characterizing. Going back all the way to 52 with something like Son of Paleface with Jane Russell and her time in the spotlight. It'd be really interesting if somebody wrote an article about Frank Toshlin and the relationship that he had with his female actresses in terms of presenting them. Susan Slept Here is a great example. Like, Debbie Reynolds in that movie is beautifully filmed, but it's a very different role than what Debbie Reynolds was known for. Yet at the same time, she's playing a character that's supposed to be very Debbie Reynolds. I'm starting to think, do I secretly think he's the best director in the world for what he's doing?
I highly recommend that everyone get the book, Toshlin-esque. It came out in 2012, if I'm remembering correctly. But it's really the only study on his work and how much he is influencing like films, even today. There's really not a whole lot of films before this that so blatantly mock the era that they are made in. And now we have one of my personal favorites, Mike Judge's Idiocracy from 2003. But before Toshlin, no one makes fun of their era to that extent. And I really do think that he's a satirical genius, but he was so out there with it that sometimes it can be hard to appreciate.
Well, I don't think people commonly make fun of the era in which they're living. There's always tends to be this remove. And we see this with history, too. Like, we didn't comment on the Vietnam War until well after we were out of it. And it's worth pointing out that he was critiquing this time period while it was still forming, before we really knew what the 50s were going to be like. His movies are spectacle and they're very silly, but they are showing us what the 50s would come to represent. And as evidenced by what we've talked about, he's calling on things that wouldn't even come to pass or that we'd still be talking about in 2019. That is insane.
He just joined and married and like saw it off on, you know, its 500th year anniversary, sex and comedy on the big screen, but like blatant sex. The whole movie's basically like Mae West wrote the dialogue, and I love Mae. Everything has some sort of innuendo behind it, and he absolutely loved it. You know, I really think that if he was still alive, he would be gladly attending screenings of Rock Hunter, and we would be looking at it for like being this sexual comedy made by this cinematic genius.
Frank Toshlin actually died relatively young in 72. He never really got, much like someone like Preston Sturges, never really got the chance to be part of the renaissance that would come once people were rediscovering these directors. He never really got to be present for the discussions of directors' works that other directors would be fortunate enough to shape their own narratives with biographers. We missed out on a lot of really unique quotes. Who knows what Frank Toshlin would be saying about his movies. And I want to say he was also married to Mary Costa. Was that the same Mary Costa who voiced Sleeping Beauty?
Mm-hmm.
Oh my gosh, that is even cooler. Frank Toshlin's got me. I forgive him for making me watch Bachelor Flat. I forgive him.
He was just a very interesting person, and Mary Costa is still very much alive. And you know,
I'm shocked that TCM didn't do with their appreciation of Falk at this year's fest. They missed an opportunity to show any of the films that he made or any of Jane's films, considering the importance to the studio.
I would think, but Jane's somebody that she's so, her personality overshadows all of her work. And I hate to say that because I absolutely love Jane. I mean, I'm sure you could tell. Jane to me is just absolutely amazing. But people think of Jane as being this overly voluptuous woman who actually was a dumb blonde. And then once in a while, people will go on about her IQ, which was reportedly 163. And then they'll come back and be like, but she was obviously very stupid. Jane's public persona overshadows everything.
Before we close out, I was going to ask, somebody watches this and they want to see more of the good representations of her work. What are the movies you recommend?
My first movie would definitely be The Girl Can't Help It. That's my favorite movie. Jane is amazing in it. I would recommend watching The Burglar, which is currently on the Criterion Channel, I believe, under their Columbia Noir. No idea why it's there, but it is. I would also recommend Too Hot to Handle. That came out in 1960, not in the US, but the first time it was released was 1960. Unfortunately, the color has been stripped. There is one color copy that is still in English, but it's never been restored and re-released, and it's over someplace in Europe. But the German edition is in color. I recommend everyone see that. Jane plays this woman who's a burlesque star, and the owner of the club that she manages is her boyfriend, and he's also a mobster. Christopher Lee is in it. He's the villain. I guess that's very fitting.
That does not seem like a combo that should exist, but now I need to know what it looks like.
It's not that I'm telling people stream movies illegally, but hint, hint, wink, wink, it's on YouTube. So everyone should watch
YouTube it. YouTube is your friend for it movies is. That the studios don't care to actually charge you money for.
Everyone should see Too Hot to Handle. It's just this very odd movie. But it's good. I mean, it's a dramatic movie. I'm actually a fan of the George Raft story. Don't take any of it as being factual, but I just love that Jane's character.
I have seen that movie.
Jane's character, Lisa, is based off of Betty Grable.
That does not make sense, but...
No, nothing with Jane ever makes sense. They were talking about having Jane play Jean Harlow for the Jean Harlow story, and I just sit there and I'm like,
what?
How would this have worked? Would you have, like, bound her breasts and her hips, and she would have just stood there the whole time? I mean, how is this gonna work?
The only commonalities they have is that they are women and they have blonde hair. That is it.
That's all you need for 1950s casting standards.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if you've seen the Harlow movies that we got, I mean, it's not like they tried very hard for those either. Maybe one day there will be a Ticklish Business episode where we look at the dueling Harlow movies from the same year. That would actually be really fun.
They'd originally talked about Jane playing Jean, and Jane really wanted to do it.
Who wouldn't have?
I mean, that's true, but then she's also like, I'll be the perfect Jean Harlow, you know, blah, blah, blah. And I'm just like, okay, Jane. And it's not because I doubt Jane's acting talents. It's just there's nothing similar. I do recommend Promises, Promises. Jane does her own singing in it. The storyline isn't horrible. It's actually extremely risque for the era. And that came out in 1963. And of course, Jane was the first American actress to appear nude on film after the Hays Code had been implemented.
Well, I'm excited to see more. This has sparked my interest in giving her movies a proper look, and I think I'm going to give Frank Toshlin a second chance. So this episode's just changing lives.
No, I'm very proud of you. No, it's definitely one of those things. Like, I do get why she's a turnoff for people. I was telling Samantha a little bit earlier, you know, I don't look at Jane with rose-colored glasses. And I understand why people can find her to be irritating or she's just not their cup of tea. But at the end of the day, she was a good comedic actress. She was a good dramatic actress. And her work deserves to be looked at. And so does Toshlin's. So does Axelrod's. He wrote Breakfast at Tiffany's, and people tend to forget that. But then he's also writing something like this. Like, that dude's just all over the place.
Well, listeners, let me know your thoughts on Jane Mansfield, Frank Toshlin, whatever you want. You can email them to us at ticklishbiz@gmail.com, and I'll read them on the next episode. I'd like to thank my guest one more time, April VBA, for joining me. April, where can fans find to get in touch with you, get the book, all of that?
Oh, goodness. So my Twitter handle is just at April VBA because I'm a really creative person.
I wish my Twitter handle was my name, so do not knock that.
That's the only blessing of having this last name. You can buy my book on Amazon. It's actually cheaper if you get it from Barnes & Noble, and you can get it on hardcover, but of course Amazon has a bigger market. You can reach me on Facebook, and I also run a page called Puffblicity, PuffBlicity, and that's on Facebook, and I have about like 5,000 likes on it. So Jane fans are out there.
And is there an update on when volume 2 of your book is going to come out?
So in the foreseeable future, as long as everything goes how it's going right now, it should be released on June 29th, which will be the 52nd anniversary of Jane's death.
Wow, that is amazing. We are just looking at all the important dates in her life today. That's going to close out this edition of Ticklish Business. You can listen to Ticklish Business a multitude of different ways, either directly at ticklishbusiness.podbean.com. We're on Stitcher Radio, Player FM, wherever you get podcasts. We're also on Spotify or on iTunes. If you're listening via iTunes, help us out and leave us a rating and a review. You can contact us directly with questions, comments, suggestions at ticklishbiz, that's B-I-Z, at gmail.com. And you can visit me at my official website where I discuss classic films regularly, journeysinclassicfilm.com. If you head over there now, I have all my TCM Classic Film Festival write-ups. I'm going to have movie reviews of what I saw, all of that. The podcast is also on Twitter at ticklish_biz. If you want to follow me on Twitter, you can do that at journeys_film. If you'd like to follow my amazing co-host, you can find Samantha Ellis at Classic Film Geek. Andrea Clark is at The Drea Clark. If you want to learn more about upcoming episodes, hear exclusive content before anyone else, then consider supporting Ticklish Business via Patreon. I have a wealth of amazing perks, All your donations go right back into making Ticklish Business the classic film podcast that it is. If you become a patron right now, you can get access to all of my TCM Classic Film Festival audio. I recorded a bunch of intros as well as all my red carpet interviews. Those are going to go up there first. You get access to these episodes 48 hours early, and you get a button. And my two supplementary shows will be coming back soon. That's patreon.com/ticklishbiz. And if you want to learn more about the stars turning 100 this year and you're a member of TCM Backlot, you can read my year-long series, Centennial Celebration, where I talk about the stars turning 100. This month, it is Howard Keel. If you want to win some stuff, this is the last week to get entered for the trio of Warner Archive titles that we are giving away. These are brand spanking new movies, one of which has Ginger Rogers in them. So all you have to do is tweet us a question, any classic film question, and as long as you were in the United States, because international shipping is really expensive, I'm sorry, you will be entered to win. More questions equals more entries. So that's going to close next week by the time this goes out, the end of the month. That's going to close us out. Next time, Drea and Samantha and I will hopefully all be reunited. We're going to be celebrating Tyrone Power. Or Tyrone Power. Sam's not here, so I can mispronounce his name. We're going to be talking about a mystery movie. We're still debating the poll. It's going to be about him, regardless. But that will be next time.